Okay, today we're going to look at some of the mitzvot of Sukkot. There's quite a few, but I'm jumping around in the books just because it's Sukkos, and why should we just study the next one in the order when we should get a little orientation to the holiday? So I should have sent an email saying, please bring book three, but I didn't. So
we're still on book one.
In next
general,
week.
We're still on book one.
Next week, we will be using book three as well.
Book one and three.
No, we won't be using book one next week.
Oh, just three.
Just three.
Okay, just three. Okay.
Just three. So I'm dividing this into the mitzvot of Sukkot. This is part one. Next week will be part two. And next year will be part three.
Okay.
Okay, so this year
book
we're...
book three next week.
Right, right. So we'll do these two this year because there's a few mitzvahs here. So this week I want to look at, there's two quick ones to look at, and then the mitzvah of dwelling in the sukkah is what we're going to concentrate on, and celebrating the holiday, which is the Rav Hirsch that I brought. So starting with the first one, which you don't really need your book for, I can read it to you, because it's pretty short. I can get back there. Okay, the precept of resting from work on the first day of Sukkot. So it's a positive commandment to rest from work that is not essential for preparing human food on the first day of the festival of Sukkot, for us in the diaspora on the first 2 days of the festival. As it is said, on the first day shall be a holy convocation. Holy convocation meaning a holiday from which one rests from work. As to the root reason for the precepts resting from work on the Sabbath and festival days, I've already written about them, that which I have known. There is one reason for them all. Some of its laws we have written in the negative precept of the prohibition of work in this sedra. It's enforced everywhere, at every time, for both man and woman. Anyone who transgresses it or disobeys a positive precept apart from violating a negative precept. And before we go into the reason for a second, I'll read you the negative one, because they sound very similar in their wording. So here's the positive one again, 318. To rest from work that is not essential for preparing human food on the first day of the festival of Sukkot.
So you can do everything but cook.
You can cook and not do anything else.
Okay.
So right. You can't do everything,
right,
but you may cook. It's like Shabbos, except for you may cook. Right?
Which for a woman is?
A lot. A lot. Right. Right. Which we'll get to in just a minute. Okay. So 319. The next one is, so the first one was a positive, to rest. 319 is a negative. Not to do any work that is not essential for preparing human food on the first day of the festival of Sukkot. So that's basically the two. One is to rest from, and one is not to do work on. So it's interesting because they both cover the same things, which means that the same behavior, if transgressed, takes you out of a positive and into a negative, both.
Wow.
It's coupled dover. covered double.
Double cover.
Yeah, it's double cover for each action. So that
really a bad thing if you work.
Right. Right, it is actually on the festival days. Yeah, you are required to rest and to not work. So it's interesting. So the positive commandment is to rest and the negative commandment is to work. So why do we have two commandments? What is that? Why do you need a double thing?
They basically say the same thing.
I guess we don't listen well. That's good. How many times do I have to tell you?
Well, the punishments for negative and positive different so that they're trying to make sure.
Well, so what would be the point? I mean, the point of a punishment, most of the points of the punishments are to teach you the severity of the law. So it's not that you should have to have two punishments. So what could be the reason for the two things?
Is it to emphasize the importance?
So I think, and I'm not 100% sure here, one is that it's a holiday, so you can't work. But the question is then, why the positive of resting? So we've discussed it before a little bit, but not quite in this way. But I've used this language, but not attached it to this. But there's two concepts of Shabbos and festivals. So there's the negative stuff and the positive stuff, right? Those are the two categories. Don't do this, do that. Why the don'ts? In general, all the don'ts are to create space. All the do's are to fill the space. So resting creates the space, and that's in fact what he says. When he said, it's enforced everywhere at every time, let's see, oh no, before that, some of his laws we've written in the negative precept of the prohibition of work on the sedra. So I'm looking at that. That's number 298, if anybody wants to look it up later. But for number 298, this is what he says. At the root of the precept, and that law is the ban on work on the first day of Passover. But in that is where he gives the reason. At the root of the precept lies the purpose, that the Jewish people should remember the great miracles that the Eternal Lord wrought for them and for their ancestors, and should talk about them and tell their children and grandchildren about them. For as a result of resting from worldly affairs and concerns, they will be free to occupy themselves with this. For if they were permitted to do work, even light work, each and every one would then turn to his business, and the glory of the festival would be forgotten from the mouths of children as well as adults. There are many further benefits in resting. All the people gather in synagogues and houses of study to hear the words of the sacred book, and the heads of the people can guide them and teach them knowledge. In keeping with what the sages of blessed memory said, Moses instituted the custom for the Israelites that they should discuss and ask about the laws of Passover on Passover and the laws of Shavuot on Shavuot. Among the laws of the precept, there is that what the sages of blessed memory said, that although Scripture permitted labors needed to prepare human food, it is specifically those things that was not possible to do the day before the festival, which Scripture permitted, such as kneading, ritual slaying, baking, and cooking, because all these things will be spoiled if left long. So now we don't slaughter on the day, although we would be allowed. But now we have refrigeration, so we can do that beforehand. But before refrigeration, you need to cook a chicken. You kill the chicken then. Excuse me, how are you going to keep it? Right? So you're allowed to do things like crushing spices, where the spice is more aromatic that day than if you do it beforehand. However, things like, even though it's required for human food, reaping, threshing, winnowing, and grinding, that can be done ahead and doesn't diminish the quality.
So logically,
you do that ahead.
Logically now, when you can do most anything ahead and preserve,
but it might diminish the quality. So, for instance, an Israeli salad does not taste good on the second day. Mm-hmm. It's wilty and yucky. So you're allowed to make it on that day. Yeah. And a roast chicken, it really tastes better the first day. It comes right out of the oven. So you're allowed to bake it that day.
But a cake, for example?
So once the category is permitted, you don't have to decide on each and every food.
I see.
The category of cooking for food. You are permitted to cook. So
if you leave the fire, though, right?
Isn't that? Yes, that's correct. You're not allowed to initiate or extinguish a fire.
So you have to leave your oven on.
Right? If you have a gas oven, which most people don't have this kind of control today, you've got an old-fashioned gas oven where you turn the knob that basically just, not electronically, but actually physically mm-hmm. opens and closes
the valve.
Then you're allowed to turn it up and down.
I still make some.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
But if that's not what you own, you can't do the electronic turning up and down.
But can you change the temperature?
So if it's electronic, you can't.
But if it's already on?
If it's already on and you have to press the button that makes the numbers go up and down, you can't do that on Yontif. If it's turning the dial.
In other words, like if the oven's on, like 200,
right,
and you want to turn it to 350 and it's just turning the dial.
And not making numbers or lights or anything like that
right.
go. So this is how you do it. You are permitted to do that, but you're not permitted to initiate a flame. So even those ovens today, most of us, even if we have that, don't have pilot lights anymore.
Right, that's right.
Right? It's electronic ignition.
Right, that's right.
So this is what you have to do. When the oven is on, you can turn it up. When the oven is off, you can turn it down. So you have to listen for the oven sound.
Oh, right.
So let's say you left it on 200 overnight, and then you stand outside the oven, you're standing right, and you hear that tick, 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 shh. So after you hear the tick, and then it's on, that's when you can turn the temperature up,
because
it's already on, and instead of making it be 200, you're just going to make it go to 350. Let's say you just leave it, you're just turning it up, and it will just stay on longer. But you did not initiate the flame, you're now just continuing it. Now, let's say if it was at 350 and now you're going to bed or whatever and you want to turn it down to 200, so you can't do that when it's at 350 because it will turn the flame off.
So you just have to wait till
you have to listen till the flame is off, right? The thermostat has turned it off. Now, in that space of it not being on, you can just shut the valve a little bit down to 200, right? So you are allowed to do it that way.
So the way you're explaining it, though, is you can do it without any food in the oven. Because normally...
Because it's not on.
Right. Because it's not on. Because normally you would do it only when.
Right. So now that's the oven. Now let's talk about the flame on top of the stove. Okay. The flame on top of the stove, or maybe even the food in the oven for turning it up, is different than turning it down. Because you're turning it down when it's off. Right? Right. You're, so that's not doing anything except for just closing the valve a little bit. You're not doing anything electronic, nothing. It's fine. You're allowed to do that. Turning it up is a problem because you are supposed to only do it for the need of cooking. Mm-hmm. So you should actually stick your food in the oven first, unless you're making a cake that needs 350 to shock the cake, right? It's, so it's for the sake of that cake, but you can't put the cake in right then. But it is for the sake of something that you immediately want to do. And the same thing with a flame. You shouldn't, let's say you just boiled water. Now you're done. You need the boiled water to pour over something in your sink, right? So now you have a high flame. What do you do with that high flame? You can't just diminish it. So you're supposed to put something on that you want to simmer, or something lower, whatever it is, or you just let the, yeah, you're not supposed to just turn it down. However, that being said, it's actually a question, now that I said it that way. Well, so the thing is, what are you actually doing halachically when you lower that flame? You're not actually lowering the flame. What you're actually doing in a, not electric, in a gas stove, on a gas flame, is you're just diminishing the flow of fuel. Right. So you're not actually turning the flame down. You're just causing less fuel to flow to the flame, and now the flame will be lower. Do you hear the difference? There's a difference, which if you don't have electronic ignition that you're going to pass, and then you have the chance of electric. I just unplug my stove for Yantif. I keep it unplugged all the time now, but I just unplug it so I don't... I have gas, but it has electronic ignition. And if the gas goes low, it clicks in, right? So now I just light it with a flame. I light it with a lighter during the year, right, or transfer. But now I don't have electronic ignition problems. I never, when I'm turning it up or down, I never pass the electronic ignition stage, right? Could click because I don't have it. So, hello. In my case, I'm permitted to turn a flame off because I'm not extinguishing it. You can't blow a match out. That's extinguishing a flame. But turning the knob all the way is not extinguishing a flame. It's ceasing the flow of fuel, and the flame will burn out by itself.
You want to plug your stove?
Well,
yes.
That's just the electronic.
I understand. How do you light your oven?
My stove and oven are separate, but my stove top, right. Yeah, my stove and oven are separate. But my stove top has just electronic start, and that it sparks the flame. Right. It's a gas flame. So I just use like a barbecue starter to start it. Or a Yantif transfer with a toothpick or with a match from the yard site candle to the, you turn on the gas and transfer it there. And you have to remember not to blow out that thing in your hand and just drop it in the empty yard site container and let it burn out. It's tricky. So that's why it's better not to do that on Yantif, because you make mistakes easily. If you have an electric oven, okay. If you have an electric oven, you can also, if the light is on, if it's not electronic and you're not pressing buttons, it's just a dial that you turn up and down, and it has an indicator light that goes on when it's heating and mm-hmm. off when it's not. When it's off, you can turn it down. When it's on, you can turn it up.
So it's the same.
But you said not necessarily on the
burner. Pardon?
You have to put something on the burner.
So that, the burner.
When you're turning it down.
So, right, so Allison's saying it is different from modern ovens and things, and I don't understand how all the modern tricky stuff. I'm talking about the simplest, plainest, old-fashioned kind. All that newfangled stuff with the electronic and computer chips is all much trickier, so I don't know. I'm not rendering psak halacha on that at all.
Okay, so the flame is full till buggy. And we want to turn it down.
Put something on it. Like, just bring it to simmer before you take the pot off.
Okay.
You know.
It says for the purpose of cooking.
Right. Right. So let's say you want your chicken soup.
On the stove when you're doing it.
Right. You want your chicken soup to be hot to serve.
Right.
Right. Now you've brought it to a boil. You're ready to serve it. But the truth is, if you would leave it on that flame, it will boil out and be disgusting. Right. So before you take it off to serve it, turn it down to simmer because that's good for the soup. It should be at simmer. Now you could take it off and serve it.
I have a hypothetical.
Okay.
Say you got a 3-day Yantif.
Uh-huh.
Not say, for example.
Let's just say.
Just say, for example.
Like, when you leave a burner on, You still gotta cover those knobs. This is what I've discovered. You gotta still cover your knobs. Because it is so automatic to turn that burner off.
You may have to make a personal fence. It is not a halachic requirement like it is on Shabbos to cover the knobs.
But it's a personal fence, right?
But if you find that you are regularly tripping up, then you probably should do that. Something to help you remember not to turn it off.
So say you accidentally...
That's why you have an Ner Neshama. Right.
You have a what?
That's why you have a Yahrzeit candle to turn it back on with. But let's say it's electric. You're in trouble. Electronic ignition gas?
Yeah,
let's plug it.
Unplug it.
What?
Yeah.
Get off of automatic.
Unplug it.
Do you have a separate stove and a separate oven? Yes. Unplug your stove.
Unplug the stove.
Yes. Because then you still have gas flowing.
Have you done that?
Yes, my stove is unplugged.
Are you afraid that gas will be...
No, the electricity does not stop the flow of gas. All it does is create the electronic spark.
So then you can turn your knob on when you want gas and put it... flame from somewhere else.
Correct.
Against it. And
correct. That's correct.
The way we always used to light gas.
Right. And back in all days.
It can be off. And then when you want gas, you just move the knob up, and you're not starting a flame except from another flame.
You are not starting. You're transferring. Yeah. That's correct. That's called transferring a flame. Because you're igniting the fuel that's there. You're not igniting. You're transferring a flame to that flammable object, which is there. You just... It's flammable that you don't see.
Just like lighting candles on the second.
So
night.
You do that all the time.
I do that, yeah.
And it works.
It does work. because the plug is in the back of the cabinet and it's annoying to plug back in.
You just leave it on.
And not just that, but because I put a blech over it and it burns out the wires underneath, which makes my thing spark all the time when it goes on simmer. So it's just annoying constantly, tick, 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 all year round until I replace those wires. I just keep it unplugged. All year round.
And light a match to it when you want. Mm-hmm. But say you did accident, okay. That's very good for the future. Say you turn off a burner accidentally.
Yeah.
Can you go tell a neighbor you have a problem?
I think that you can in a case like this on Yom Tov.
On Yom Tov, you can.
Yeah, it's different than on Shabbos.
Shabbos, you cannot.
No, let's say your chillant flame went out. Mm-hmm. You're allowed to turn the gas off so it won't fill up your house. Like, let's say a big gust of wind comes through your kitchen and blows out that flame, which occasionally happens. Mm-hmm. Then you're allowed to turn the gas off so your house won't fill up with gas. But you can't go ask somebody to relight your flame for you. It's on Shabbos.
Well,
the end of it is different.
Can you have a goy light your flame so it doesn't turn off? Mm-hmm. Period. Even on
Yantif? Yes. You're asking now about Bishol Akum, right? That's your question?
It's not good food unless you started
the flame. So that's not it. You have to go back a little bit further. Food has to be cooked by a Jew, right? Food has to be cooked by a Jew to make it kosher, okay? So the question is, what is the definition of cooked by a Jew? We Ashkenazim have the extreme leniency, Sephardim do not hold by this, but we Ashkenazim have the extreme leniency that if just the flame was lit by a Jew, that's enough cooking that everything was cooked by a Jew. So if a rabbi walks in, turns on the ovens in the bakery, then all of that bread counts as Pas Yisrael. Even though he didn't put his hands in the flour, he didn't sift anything, measure anything, knead anything, nothing. Mm-hmm. Just turned on the flame. That's our leniency. It doesn't mean that if a non-Jew turns on the flame, the food is now not kosher if you're cooking it.
So the reverse isn't true.
Right. Okay. You can cook the food. Right? Now, some people would hold. I mean, some people would be worried about that. But you have to... So that means that, let's say you're an executive person, right? You're out of the house all day long. You allow your housekeeper to cook all your food for you so that you have dinner when you come back. You leave the flame on before you go because that's the leniency. You're allowed to do that. But... if now they left the flame on and you still have that person because they work for you 5 days a week and it just happens to be Yantif, you go to shul and now they're cooking for you like they usually do. No, you're not covered, right? Then they made everything
because
the non-Jew lit the flame,
okay.
Right?
And they actually prepare
the food. But all you have to do, I mean, you can do another tiny little thing. Open the pot, stir it, add some salt. Oh, you cooked it.
If only it was that easy.
I'm just saying, something. You have to do something to contribute to the cooking.
Okay, but if you... Okay.
Lighting the flame is a something. Stirring the pot and adding some salt is a something. Mm-hmm. Chopping the vegetables and plopping them in the water is a something. You do something to contribute to the cooking of that, then it counts as you cooked it. Okay? Okay. Anyway. Do we? We
so
probably have a few
don't
more.
Don't extinguish the flame. When you're doing that thing with your stove, that's where
I walk in. Right. Don't extinguish it.
She's hoarding this.
Time has all of them.
I'm covering my burners now, just like a dry shop, so I know at least I have to lift off the foil.
Oh.
It reminds me.
Right, so you have to, that's your own thing. You just have to remember that that's not halacha.
It's not halacha.
It is not halacha. That's your own personal fence, which is important to make your own personal fences. But that's your own personal fence. Okay, so we see now that the first mitzvah that we looked at, resting, is to create space. And then we need a separate prohibition on work, because it's usher to work on a yentif. Right?
Not working was to create space.
The resting, resting is to create space.
Oh, I thought the negative was to create space.
And the not working, right. So in general, you're right. It is. The not having the work to do is creating the space. So, and the resting. So in this case, it's really the same. So we're left with the same question. How am I answering that? How am I answering that question? I don't have a full answer for you. I'll have to work on that one. But anyway, we do have... It's a good question. Why do we have the two?
Question, maybe think about if there are other things where we have a positive and a negative
that
say the
both.
Same thing, basically.
Right. Can I borrow your pen for a second and I'll just write that?
Because I think that might help find the answer to the question.
Don't work creates the space. Do rest fills the space.
That's what you said the first time.
Right, right. No, it's true. So the question is, that's the case. The not working creates the space.
Right.
The stuff that we're supposed to do in it, listening to the Torah and the discussion and the having the meals and all the do's, fill the space. So the question remains, why do we have a do and a don't on the same thing?
The objective really is the same.
Right, so I'm not 100% there. But let's move on to our juicier one of the day, the precept of, this is a quick one. Precept of Musa, quickie. That's just a quick one. That there is, just because we are going through all 613, there is a mitzvah, which we're not going to go into right now, because we're going to do a whole section on the offerings and musafs and all that stuff. So we're just breezing over this one quickly. It's a very short one. There is a mitzvah to offer an additional offering on Sukkot. That's it. So you got to do it. Well, yeah, so that mitzvah, the additional offering that we used to offer in the sanctuary is now replaced by the additional service. So, yes, it does mean you get to sit in the shul a little bit longer. The question of why and all that stuff was we will discuss all the musaf offerings at a different time. But just because it's in the chunk of mitzvahs of Sukkot, we just want to mention that one. Okay, now, the mitzvah...
And each day of Sukkot, that's interesting.
Oh, it's actually very interesting. And one thing that I will say to you, it's each day of Sukkot... And one thing I'll tell you is that Sukkot is considered the universal holiday, meaning that it doesn't pertain only to the Jews. Pesach is Jews and Jews only. Shavuos is Jews and Jews only. Right? Pesach is when we became a nation. It has nothing to do with the non-Jews. Shavuot is when we got the Torah. It has nothing to do with the non-Jews. Sukkot does. Sukkot is us... It is about the Jews wandering through the desert, which we'll talk about, and the clouds of glory that surrounded us and God taking care of us. So that has to do with the Jews. And yet, there's an aspect of universality that pertains to everybody else. And so we offer offerings on their behalf.
Are you supposed to invite non-Jews to your sukkah?
You could invite non-Jews to your sukkah. You're not supposed to invite non-Jews on Yentif unless they're in the process of conversion. And seriously so. Like not just somebody who's curious. That somebody who's already made the commitment and is in process, you are permitted to invite them. But in general, you're not supposed to invite non-Jews on Yontif because of the prohibition of not serving, cooking. So if you do end up inviting one, let's say, God forbid, or it happens occasionally that one of your friends or children or relatives is married to a non-Jew. You can't invite your child and not their spouse, right? You're going to invite both, right? So now you've invited a non-Jew into your sukkah, and they're not in the process of conversion. And even a non-Jew in the process of conversion, you're not permitted to cook for on Yontif. So you have to be very careful. So let's say they're sleeping in your house, and in the morning it's Pesach, you make matzah brei for everybody. You have to make matzah brei for everybody, put it in a big dish, and then everybody can take. But you can't ask each person. You can't make, like, let's say, omelets. You want a cheese omelet, you want a mushroom, I'll make each one for you, and you're making for the non-Jew. You're not allowed to do that. The place, so there's that. It doesn't often happen that you're cooking individual portions on Yom Tov. Usually we're cooking in big pots, so it's not a problem. You just have to have that in mind. You know, let's say you have a vegetarian non-Jew, and you made soup for them. Right? You can't just heat that soup up for them on Yom Tov. It has to be for everybody. Yeah, somebody else has to eat it, and then since it's already hot, you could give it to them too. So you have to be very conscious if you have a non-Jew. And the other place to be very conscious of... Oh, wine, yeah. The other place I'm saying that happens regularly on Yom Tov is serving tea. Because on Shabbos, you do a klish lishi so that you're not cooking the tea. But on Yom Tov, you can put the tea bag in and pour the hot water directly on it and serve it to everybody. You're allowed to cook, right? So for the non-Jew, just serve the hot water and the tea bag and let them cook it for themselves, right? You just have to be thinking. It's tricky. It's tricky.
On Shabbos, because you're not cooking on Shabbos anyway.
You're not cooking on Shabbos. That's correct. Shabbos, you're not permitted to do anything different for eating, and so a non-Jew is permitted to come to your house. Now, you want to be careful about the non-Jew that you invite, because you don't want a non-Jew who will dilute your Shabbos environment. A non-Jew who is curious and respectful, you could invite. A non-Jew who has derision for religion and, you know, is ruining your Shabbos environment, you know, let's say the teenage child of a friend who's curious, they should be excluded, you know, if you can. So it's in a graceful way, but they shouldn't. They don't have a place at your Shabbos table, really. You know, you don't need somebody who's obnoxious about Shabbos. If they're a Jew, you're working on bringing them in. But if they're a non-Jew, there's no point in having somebody who's taking away from Shabbos at a Shabbos table.
So say, okay, I have a cousin that's married to a non-Jew. Mm-hmm. And he's more interested now, I think, in learning more. But he won't know the difference if I don't invite him. So I'd like to have him come to the sukkah. Mm-hmm. And yet he won't know the difference if I don't. He won't be upset. He won't know. But is it preferable then to just not...
You can invite him on Shabbos. However he gets there. He's anyway going to be driving. So you can invite him on Shabbos when it's mutter to invite the non-Jew. Or invite him during the week for a meal.
Just not on that.
Right.
No, stay away from Yom Tov.
Yeah.
Even if you're going to have that in mind. Because I think Rabbi Stern said if there's going to be hostility because of it, then you can do it.
All right, for sure. Yeah, you can. So you're inviting your sister and brother and cousin, and you are excluding your cousin because he's married to a non-Jew? Don't exclude him. Invite him. But if he doesn't know anyway, so it doesn't matter. You're not creating hostility by not inviting him. Just choose your invitation time.
What if it's a Jew that is very hostile?
You could.
That's what I was going to ask, and then okay. I decided we had enough officers.
That's unlikely that they would be more hostile than what.
So that really depends on why you're inviting that Jew that's hostile. You know, if they're a family member and you kind of have to invite them, so you kind of have to invite them. But there's no reason to extend yourself to invite a Jew that's hostile. You don't need that, you know. So.
Outwardly hostile or
Yeah, all kinds of stuff.
Okay.
We Jews are a complicated bunch.
Let's go dwell in the sukkah.
Yes, okay, dwelling in the sukkah. Okay, dwelling in the sukkah is Mitzvah 325. So we're skipping quite a few. Which book am I in? This one, yeah.
Hard to stay organized with all the cooking odd discussions.
Okay, 325. So, okay, the Mitzvah dwelling in the sukkah. So we're commanded to dwell in the sukkah 7 days, 8 days in the diaspora. As it says, you shall abide in booths 7 days, the first day being the 15th of Tishrei. At the root of the precept lies what is distinctly explained in Scripture. It is in order that we should remember the great miracles which God, blessed is He, wrought for our fathers in the wilderness when they went out of Egypt. For He formed a covering of clouds of glory for them, so that the sun should not injure them by day or frost at night. Remember, they're in the desert where it's super hot in the day and cold at night. And there are those who explain that the Israelites actually made Sukkot, or booths, in the wilderness. Then, thus remembering His works that He did with us and with our forefathers, we will take care to observe His precepts, and we will be worthy of receiving the good reward from Him. This is His desire, blessed is He, as He delights in bestowing good. So this is an interesting paragraph, that's why I read the whole thing out loud. Because you get a few things here. A, why are you doing it? Because we're remembering God's goodness. And we're remembering the Exodus. So we have the classic question that's asked about Sukkot. Why are we celebrating it in the fall when the Exodus was in the spring? You know?
Right.
Right. It really should be that it's Pesach, Sukkot, Shavuos. That makes sense.
Right. That would right? be the
Sukkot,
right order.
We got Sukkot out, should be we got during Sfiras HaOmer time.
We got the time.
Yeah,
right.
We wandered for 40 full years.
Yeah, but not at this point. I mean, yeah, we did later, but at
we
first...
We haven't wandered yet.
At first, we'd wandered for the 49 days. We walked for the 49 days.
Got the Torah, and then...
Got the Torah, and then made our mistakes, and then... And then had the spies. This is the spies, right? It's the spies really that gave us the 40-year thing, right? The whole story with the spies. So, but still, so the question. So, there is the classic question: why now and not then? So, one reason for that, and the classic answer for that is, if everybody would go and live in booths in the springtime, they and everybody around them, because we are thinking about what the non-Jews think of us when they watch us. So it's the Jews and the non-Jews who watch them would say to themselves and about us, it's lovely outside. Of course they're going out to dine on their patio. You know?
Of course.
So,
to me, that's not a very good answer because all of this occurred, if you think about where it occurred, it's plenty nice at this time of the year too there. In the Middle East at this time
right,
of
but
year,
this is
lovely.
Not, yes, but it's not a time of going out, it's a time of coming in. It's that it is a difference. The fall is the time of starting to go in, whereas the spring is the time when you start to go out. So it would look just like we're going out. And it could be cold and yucky during that time of year, too. Either side, right, depending on when it falls.
This year it looks like it's going to be beautiful.
This year it looks like it'll be great, I hope. Yeah, it won't be cold. It'll be really nice. But it is to separate us, to make a distinction, and for us to get that.
Everybody else is covering their patios. We're
right. So, but there's more to it than that. Okay, so that's the classic, is that, you know, just to make the time distinction, that this is the time of going in and we're going out. The time of hunkering down, the time of harvest, the time of putting up things, the time of canning, the time of reaping. So we do want to have a festival for that. Thank you, God, that you gave us so much bounty. We are doing that, but that it is a time of preparing for winter. So the preparing for winter time is not the time that you're going out. It is the time that you're gathering in. So that's a different aspect. So you are going out. So we are reaping. We are harvesting at this time. We have a few different harvests throughout the year. But this is one of them. It's interesting. Another name for Shavuot is Chag that's Chag HaKatif, and this is Chag HaAsif, I think. That's
planting.
This is the gathering. Uh-oh.
No, the winter wheat. The winter wheat.
Right, they're both. Right, so which is Chag HaAsif? Do you remember? One is Chag HaAsif also, and now I'm confused. Okay, so I'm not going to say. So hard to be dyslexic.
In Hebrew.
And I mean, just dyslexic makes your thoughts switch, too. Like I just get mixed up, you know, lefts and rights. Somebody said, you know, do this, you'll be able to see whichever one makes an L. That's left. I'm like, well, they're both L's to me. It doesn't help at all. Not at all. Okay, anyway. So we are harvesting right now. Another thing that we're harvesting is all the hard work that we did during Elul and Rosh Hashanah and Sukkot.
I like that one.
The spiritual harvest. There is the physical harvest, but we have a spiritual harvest that's happening here as well. And we have a tremendous simcha over that spiritual harvest. So this is a holiday of joy. Pesach is Zman Chayrutenu, the time of our freedom. Shavuot is Zman Matan Torahtenu, the time of giving the Torah. But Sukkot is Zman Simchatenu, the time of our simcha. So the simcha is, the physical harvest certainly helps with the simcha. But the spiritual harvest also really helps. This is a time, all the... It is.
That's
it's a beautiful thing.
I like that one.
It's a beautiful thing, and it's important to understand that all the work that we did or didn't do during Elul, Rosh Hashanah, and the Aseret Yemei Teshuvah and Yom Kippur, that entire period of heaviness, because it's a heavy period of introspection and work and then a little nervousness, right? All that work, the same results can be accomplished through Simcha now. That this is the time to accomplish all that through joy. So not that we shouldn't be working on it at that time, but we do have now a harvest of joy because we feel like we achieved something. I transformed myself. I have a new start. Thank you, God, for judging me, releasing me, and then allowing me to go on with the year. So it is a time of joy. And that's why we dwell in the sukkah, which reminds us of the clouds of glory. So in this paragraph it says, it's not clear, there are yesh v'yesh, there are those who say they actually built booths in the desert. And there are those who say that the booths that we build today are symbolic, that reminds us of the actual clouds of glory that surrounded us in the desert, that were like a sukkah, that protected us that way. So, but either which way, Kabbalistically, the sukkah is reminiscent of the clouds of glory. Not just reminiscent. They shine the same light. So, I mean, the parable that I figured out over the years just to think about is like a glow-in-the-dark object. Right? If you have a glow-in-the-dark object, it can shine light, but only if you hold it to a light first. So you hold it to a light, it absorbs light, however it does that, but it does. Then you turn off the lights, and it shines, right? But it only shines a certain amount until it runs out of light. So in a way, we can't run out of light totally, but we are, in a way, like glow-in-the-dark creatures. We live in a world of darkness, and we're supposed to be a light unto the nations. From whence our light, right? So, A, from receiving the Torah, which is why we can't ever run out totally. The Torah and its ideas are the light that we spread to the world, and we're still spreading them slowly, slowly, loping along. However, if we want to really charge our light, we sit in the sukkah every year. And the longer we can sit in the sukkah, the more hours we spend in the sukkah, the more light we can absorb.
That's why we commandeered a sukkah.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's why you need a sukkah. It's very important.
We commandeered somebody else's.
Yeah, it's very important to have a sukkah, a kosher sukkah that you sit in as much as possible, not just eat your meals in it. But if you can, you could sleep in it. You certainly chat in it. Some people sleep in it, you know, and they try to.
It could be lovely.
Consider that halacha.
Well, here's the thing. I'm speaking to women. We are not bound by this mitzvah, but we still get tremendous light out of this mitzvah. So while we will not transgress if we have a meal inside or if we sleep inside, we will still benefit tremendously as we spend as much time as possible outside. So we should do everything that is a seemly activity in the sukkah. So even things that aren't not nice, like you're not supposed to leave a garbage can there. You're allowed to bring garbage to clear, right? But then you have to take it out. No garbage cans in the sukkah, no pots in the sukkah. Even if you're the type that serves from a pot, like during the week you put the pot on the table, we don't bring pots into the sukkah. It's not usur. It's not appropriate.
Wait, don't bring your...
No pots in the sukkah. No pots.
You're supposed to... Serving soup? Go out of the sukkah to get your food?
No, you should put it in a serving dish.
Put it in a serving dish.
I
can't bring my pot of soup to serve it.
You're not actually supposed to. You should put it in a tureen. You will not transgress if you do that. But the sukkah is very holy. And we are very careful to treat it with proper respect.
Am I supposed to eat breakfast in the sukkah?
Yes. Yeah. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, read your books out there. If you could take a nap out there, even if you're not spending the night. But if you could put something comfy, an easy chair out there. So then take your nap out there. If you have friends come over to chat, sit out in the sukkah. If you're playing board games with your grandkids, with your kids, sit in the sukkah. The sukkah is the place to be. If you're beating during the week, sit in the sukkah. If you're doing a crossword, as long as you're the type that writes during Chol Hamoed, sit in the sukkah, right?
So why no soup pot? What did you say about that?
It's not seemly. Oh, so that's what I was going to say, not seemly. So you're not supposed to do it. You're not supposed to use the sukkah for going to the bathroom, even though that's something you do all the time, and you do it in your house. So that's outside the sukkah. But yeah, even like ironing, you don't bring your laundry and fold it in the sukkah. Like you might do that in your living room, but in general, you keep that in your laundry. It's not unseemly, but it's not sukkah appropriate. Like you don't, so you're not going to bring your basket of laundry and fold it there and iron there because it's just, that's not a sukkah activity.
Well, you don't do those things on Shabbos, but you would serve
during Chol Hamoed
a soup pot on Shabbos. What's unseemly about a soup pot? I'm having a hard time getting that.
So I think this is the subjective aspect, okay? So objective, there's halachas. Objective is halachas. Subjective is what you think is appropriate. So I'll give you an example of subjective.
It's nicer to put it in a serving piece.
Well, I'll give you an example of
subjective. I have a great soup tureen. I'll loan it.
Here's an example, okay? Objectively, the halacha is wear Shabbos clothes on Shabbos. Honor the Shabbos. One of the ways of honoring the Shabbos is by wearing Shabbos clothes, right? The Shabbos clothes we wear here at H. Denver or in Denver, Colorado, wouldn't really fly in the middle of Brooklyn. You know, they're not dressy enough. People would look at us and say, Don't you have Shabbos clothes?
And vice versa. In lots of parts of Israel, the stuff they wear
right.
on Shabbos would never fly here.
Right, right. So that's subjective.
Denim skirt.
But here, it's Shabbistic.
Yeah,
it's okay to wear that. It's not. There's not an objective, you have to wear a dark suit and a light, you know, kikiriki to pass for Shabbos clothes. It's there is subjective standards of Shabbos clothes in every community, and you have to do that, right? So you wouldn't wear a denim skirt to shul, right, on Shabbos. That's not Shabbistic in this community. On a kibbutz, a new denim skirt is just fine for Shabbos. So
okay, but the soup
so pot. Now this is taking that back to the soup pot.
Getting a little trouble with the
okay.
soup pot.
Now let's
saying if we cooked.
Now let's say now,
a lot of food for Yontif. We got 3 days here coming up.
Right.
A lot of it's done in foil pans. Are you saying don't bring a foil pan out?
So now I'm saying this depends on your mama. If your mother let you put a carton of orange juice on the table when you're serving guests, then you can put tinfoil on your table. But if your mother said, how could you put a carton on the table? Pour that into a pitcher. And she drilled that into you. Then you put it into a pitcher. Okay? It really depends on your own.
My babysitter from when I was a tiny child said, and she grew up, you know, she raised 7 kids in the Depression. She said, if you can afford the milk, you can afford the pitcher to put it in. And I
will buy
that.
So right, so it
wouldn't want you to put that.
So here's, so I think it really depends. That's why I'm saying it's subjective, like Shabbos clothes.
Okay.
It really depends.
So you're just saying it's nicer to put things in serving.
Much nicer,
okay.
Much nicer.
Well, not only that,
so
you're hoping that
the Shechina should be right, right. So I would say that.
Yeah, they're on Shabbos, and I serve out of it.
You should get a tureen, or you serve the bowls from the kitchen. Right. Right. So yeah, you got to be careful. Okay. Getting back. Okay. Okay. So we do want to make sure that we honor the sukkah by bringing only nice things into the sukkah. Some people, and I'm not saying this for us. But some people would say no paper in the sukkah. I'm not saying that for us. Get pretty paper. Don't just do Costco paper. So I'll get pretty paper. Honor the sukkah, right? Don't use what you use week long just because you can get away with it. Don't. It's Sukkot, right? Even for a weekday meal, you're sitting down and having breakfast in the middle of the week of Sukkot. So don't use a regular, you know, use something a little nicer if you're using paper. So just get nicer paper for Sukkot in honor of the Yontif so that you are honoring it. It's nicer. Okay, so now, so that's the beginning. Oh, and then what I want to say, the other part of this paragraph that's interesting is just his little sliding in a philosophy here. Not only do we want to remember the wonders that he did for us with our, so here's his chain, right? Thus we will remember the wonders he did with us. And then we will take care to observe his precepts. So as we remember the wonders, we will get motivated to observe the mitzvahs. When we observe the mitzvahs, we will then make ourselves worthy of receiving the good reward from him. And that's the whole point of everything. That's what he says here.
Remember the wonders to do the mitzvah.
Remember the wonders to get the motivation to do the mitzvah. Do the mitzvah to make ourselves into proper receivers of his goodness. That is why God made the world. So I'll just read the sentences again so you hear that in his words. Then, thus remembering his wonders he did with us and with our forefathers, we will take care to observe his precepts, and we will be worthy of receiving the good reward from him. This is his desire. Blessed is he, as he delights in bestowing good. That's all God wants. That's the whole thing. Boil it down into one nutshell. He just wants to give us good. All we have to do is shape ourselves into containers for it. That's it. That's our whole job. His whole thing, I want to give you. Our whole thing, I want to make myself into a receiver. That's it. So that's all of Judaism boiled down into one little nutshell. Right. Right. That's it. God's the nut. We're the shell. We just have to make ourselves into a shell that can hold the nut. That's the whole thing. It's Judaism in a nutshell. Right. Okay. So then among all the laws, which I don't want to go into because I want to say something about simcha also. Among all the laws is how tall should the sukkah be? How big does it have to be? What's the property of the roof? The roof has to be natural stuff that's not connected to the ground. It can't be branches that are still growing. It can't be an arbor that grew over and then you just severed it at the bottom, because when it grew over, it was connected. You could sever it and then lift up each branch and set it back down, because then you made it into proper schach. But the schach, the covering of the sukkah, has to be specifically made and specifically placed for the sake of schach.
You have to have schach.
Yes.
That's what makes
the sukkah. That's the whole thing. You can't. The sukkah doesn't exist until you put schach on it.
Four walls don't count.
No.
You need a roof. You need a
must have a temporary roof.
Through which
that's more shade than sun, but you should still be able to see the, that's the general rule. More shade than sun, but still be able to see the stars at night.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, the whole sukkah is schach. Like a...
The nylon cloth that goes around the poles is...
Nothing. You have to have, two and one tefach. Two walls and a tefach, at least. Tefach is from here to here on a man. That's a tefach. So it's about 4 inches approximately.
A little bit taller.
Yeah, a little bit more than me. But from the top of your fist to the bottom, I'm just saying, for the tape here, that's what a tefach is. So it has to be two walls, and at least the third wall has to be at least one tefach. So it could just be a little corner, right? Mm-hmm. And the walls don't have to be temporary. The walls could be your house.
One side.
Yeah, could be one side. Could be two sides. And then you just make that little tefach, right? And then you're all set. It's supposed to look like a hug. Your sukkah is supposed to look like a hug. You should definitely make a sukkah.
I could definitely.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't make one now.
Why not?
Because I don't have the materials.
We'll talk.
She's got a son.
You can get amazing Sukkot these days.
Yeah, you can. But you can also make one not that difficultly. It's pretty easy. As a matter of fact, if you're traveling, first of all, if you're really traveling, you're exempt. But if you're traveling just, let's say, on a day trip, you can make a Sukkah out of your car. Right? We used to do it with our van, because we had the van that had the barn doors, not the sliding door. Open the barn doors. Put branches. Put branches and you're done. Schach. Sukkah. Right? Take the branches off.
Branches on your door? Hanging from your door?
Open your doors.
Put branches over your door. Gotcha.
And put branches across. And then you have the third wall is inside the car. And those are the two walls. And you have schach on top. That's a sukkah. So you can make it any how way you want. You could take a picnic table and tip it up against your house. And then somehow balance schach. There are specific things. It's not, you do have to have somebody who knows a little bit help you out with that, but it's not that hard. So, okay, because I want to get to the Rav Hirsch, let's move to that. Now, if you own these Hirsch Chumashim, look up this mitzvah. There's a ton of information. It's not the mitzvah of Sukkah, it's the mitzvah of Lulav and Etrog. Okay, it's very long. It's in Leviticus, Vayikra 23. Verse 40 is a 23 verse 40 in your Hirsch Chumash. It's like 8 pages. 23 verse 40.
She just gave us
40. Right.
Chapter 23
verse 40. Yeah, that's what has all the information. Lachem b'yom rishon pri etz hadar. Right, take for yourselves a citrus fruit, right? And so it has tons of information on that. We're just going to look at one thing. Now, I'm sure everybody's heard, but I'll just repeat just so you remember this concept of the four species that we take represent four types of Jews. And we have to have every type of Jew to make it kosher. We can't leave a single one out. It's so interesting. Somebody came to me after one of my talks here on Yom Kippur, and everybody's all inspired, like, oh, I'm going to grow, I'm going to be, I'm going to do, I'm going to, like, rah, 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 right? But this one woman comes over to me. She says, could I ask you a question? I said, sure. She said, don't you think there's a place for a secular Jew like me in this picture? And I said, sure there is, but you're not accomplishing then all the stuff that we talked about. That's fine. You could be secular. That's your choice. But that's not accomplishing all this. She wanted me to tell her, it's fine. Don't worry about the mitzvahs. Just you're off the hook. Oh. You know, that's what she wanted
because
for me.
Because I choose to be secular.
Yeah, because she chose. Why she took.
She
she's an H because she's a mother of somebody. So I said, she said, what, you know, what's the point of all that? And I said, you know, it's you have an eternity ahead of you. She said, no, I don't. I'm 82. And the daughter said, no, Ma, your eternity is ahead of you. Your eternity. And if someone's wearing all designer everything. And I said, I could tell by your clothes that you really are careful about how you present yourself and how you decorate yourself and most likely your home too. You know, don't, she said, well, I have two daughters. And she's telling me before, I have two daughters that are religious. Isn't that enough? So I looked at her and I said that, you know, I see, you know, from your Chanel and Van Cleef and Arpels and all that stuff, you know, that you care a lot about how you, I said, do you want somebody else to decorate your Olam Haba for you? Like, and so the daughter said,
did you say that?
Yeah, I did. And the daughter, she said, I don't mind. And her daughter looked at her and said, Ma, you would want me to decorate it for you? I don't think so.
She didn't hear it. I'm not sure about the musician who made the choice.
I don't think so. I mean, she may have heard it, but I don't think she heard it. Yeah, no. She's not interested in hearing it. That being said, however, there is a place for her, as there is for every Jew. And the whole Torah cannot be the Torah without all of us. So,
are you saying we couldn't have a whole Torah if every one of us was observant?
Oh, we could, but we still need all of us, secular or not secular. We need every single one of us. There is no excluding. So that's what I would like to convey to her. She stopped listening after I wasn't confirming that it's okay to be secular. But each person...
God wants her to be secular.
No. Each person is totally in charge of their own choice and will be held responsible and given reward and punishment for their own choice, the path that they take. Nevertheless, every single Jew is 100% necessary in Klal Yisrael. We cannot do without a single one. We must include them all. Everyone is important. So how do we know that? One of the ways, and we know that, that's a fact, but the Lulav and Etrog remind us of that. So the Lulav and Etrog are four species, and the four species have different qualities. The Etrog has a taste and a smell. The Lulav, which is a date palm, has a taste of dates, but no smell. The Hadas, the myrtle branch, has a smell.
Taste, but no smell. Now, where are we?
The myrtle branch, which is the hadas,
has a
nice smell, but no taste, has no fruit, no taste. And the willow branch, the aravot, have no taste and no smell.
See, now, I was reading, because I was just in Oregon, where they have, like, the only myrtle, besides in Israel, I guess, and they use it like bay leaves, that you can eat it, because what I read was not that it doesn't have a taste, but that you can't eat it. But they do eat myrtle. That they use it like a bay leaf, and they sell it like a spice.
Interesting.
It has no taste. It has smell and no taste.
Well, but so it's imparting a spice. Yeah, I guess it's imparting. Right.
But what I read is not that it doesn't have taste, but that you can't eat it. And so is it that it doesn't?
I think it's that it's not a food. Like, even if you're eating it like a bay leaf, even a bay leaf you don't eat.
Oh, okay.
Right? You
that
don't.
Makes more sense. Because I just had come back from there, and then I was reading
right.
this.
It's not a food.
It was like, oh, no, that's not
yeah.
what I said.
Okay. Yeah.
I'll talk to you later. I'll find out who's coming.
Now, I always mix up taste and smell as part of my dyslexia, so let me just look. The hadas has a scent, lacks taste. So taste is... Taste is Torah learning. Smell is good deeds. Smell... is good deeds.
Wait, I missed it. Start
smell.
Is this the first one you mentioned?
No, just the concept. The smell equals good deeds. Yeah, the smell, let's see, I just want to make sure I'm doing this right, because I'll just read this one out loud so you can make sure that I'm not dyslexicizing, because I always mix it up. Okay, the Aravos tree, which refers to Israel, okay, is the, for just as the Hadas, okay, so... Hadas. No. That's not Aravos. It's Avos. I put an extra letter in there. The Hadas, the myrtle, has scent, but no taste. Okay, we know that. So too, there are Jews who possess good deeds, scent, but lack Torah learning, taste.
Smell is good deeds.
Smell is good deeds, taste is Torah learning. Smell is good deeds, taste is Torah learning. So, that's what Jews need, good deeds and Torah learning, right?
More etrog.
Right, so an etrog has taste and smell. An etrog represents the Jew that has both good deeds and Torah learning. The hadas, with the smell but no taste, represents the Jew who has good deeds but no Torah. The date palm, which has a taste but no smell, represents the Jew who doesn't have good deeds but does have Torah learning. Right? It's possible to be learned and not behave nicely.
Which one is that?
Mm-hmm. That's the date palm. The lulav. The lulav. Lulav. The lulav has Torah learning but not good deeds. And the aravot, the willow, has neither. So these represent the four types of Jews. Those who learn and do, those who don't learn and don't do, those who learn and don't do, and those who do and don't learn. Right? Those are the four types. That's it. That's all there is. You can't have a different type than that. Right? Without all four together, you can't fulfill the mitzvah. You must have all the Jews together.
So the symbol of Sukkot is Jewish unity.
Jewish unity. So that is one of the symbols. I definitely recommend you read this whole long Rav Hirsch. But the, what I want to point out in this Rav Hirsch. Rav Hirsch Chumash. And I passed out one sheet of it. So I gave you all one page. This one page talks about the simcha that comes from knowing your place in Judaism, from knowing who you are and where you belong in the Jewish scene. So, and it talks about how there will be total simcha if everybody is comfortable with who they are in the Jewish picture, that the simcha comes from feeling comfortable with your role. Whatever your role is, some people are Kohanim, some people are Levi'im, some people are not, the Yisraelim. Some people are men, some people are women, some people are executives, and some people are water haulers. And it's okay. You know, everybody could be their own person.
But it's not okay to be not a doer and not a learner. How can you be happy with that?
You can't be happy with that.
Well, I can't be happy with that.
Secular Jews are often doers, though.
They are often doers.
Often doers, not Torah learners.
Yeah, but they're doing for the wrong reason.
Not necessarily. There are, I mean, there's...
They care about mankind.
I understand
really
that,
about
but, they, but, they, but if they're not doing the it because there's a commander...
So then there is a deficiency. But let me just tell you one thing, for instance... I mean, it's a little trickier for the secular Jew in this country. It's a little trickier. Let's go to the secular Jew in Israel, okay? The guy who's eating treif and who isn't thinking about God at all, but is living in Israel and serving in the army there, right? He's doing what you're not, you know? He is fulfilling the mitzvah of Yishuv Haaretz and defending the borders of that country. And without him, we couldn't... 613 mitzvot cannot be fulfilled by any one person. So we all have to work together.
And the Menachem Segal is, I'm sure he goes to a Seder on Pesach and probably
maybe not. Maybe not. Maybe not. There are plenty who don't. Plenty who don't.
Statistic that 58% of Israelis are observant now.
No, no, no. That was not the statistic. The statistic was something like 58% are going to fast on Yom Kippur. Will observe Yom Kippur. Not that they're observant. No, it's not 58% or Shomer Shabbos.
No, not Shomer
Shabbos. No, 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 no.
On the road, they're more observant.
No, no, so they
have a Seder and they fast on.
Yeah. That's not observant. But that is connected.
Yeah,
for sure. For sure. We'd like to see it a little higher than that. If you're just going to, you know, if you're going to call it fasting and Kippur and going to a Seder, so it would be very nice to have that number be in the 90s. You know, if you're bringing it down to that. You know, so 58 is not in the biggest triumph, but...
It's growth.
Yeah, it's growth. It is growth. It is growth, and it is growing. So, right, but this, so I guess you'll have to read about the simcha on your own, but just so read that one page that I, you know, for homework, you take it with you. But it is a beautiful thing to think about the simcha of the yontif and the simcha that's there from having your spot in the nation, about the whole nation being together, and having your spot in that nation, being comfortable with your place there. So I guess we'll end on that. And next week we're going to continue with a few more mitzvahs of Sukkot.